Scott Woods here. It's November 29th, 2009, talking with Bob Dobbs in Maui. How you doing, Bob?
Great. I'm enjoying what we've done and looking forward to tonight.
Excellent. Well, we have a few sort of areas we wanted to probe around in, I guess, but I wanted to actually start, Bob, with something I almost wish I had started or asked you in the first chat we did a few weeks ago. It just kind of seems so glaringly obvious that, well, why didn't I start with this? So I want you to just, if you can, describe for me what you think the role of the critic is traditionally and what, if anything, is the role of the critic today.
Do you mean a rock critic or any level of
No, criticism? Just a critic, just a critic in general, because, you know, I've listened a lot, I've heard you describe a lot, you talking about the role of the artist and that sort of thing, and how there, you know, there can be no artists today because we're all living inside the situation, is I think how you put it. So how does the critic, you know, I'm interested in the critic's relationship to the artist, so.
Well, the critic, I would take the broadest interpretation, begins with the shaman in tribal societies. The critic is someone who sees, shows you how to see through the situation you're inside of. So the shaman used to put them on drugs, right? Plant drugs, do different healing techniques, and then you get more complex societies, agricultural societies, and they might still have the shaman thing, but the critic might be the priest. And then you move into writing, and then the critic becomes a Plato and write stuff. So the critic is always trying to show you the world and create a detachment or a lightening, lightening up, making less heavy your burdens of consciousness. Right. So that, the most general expression of that is McLuhan's term, anti-environmental. McLuhan said any person of integral awareness, whether artistic, scientific, or humanistic, and then we could throw in tribalistic, shamanistic, knows the situation, the ground rules of his environment, and throws light on it or allows you to be freed from it in a way. So that is not just being having a point of view. You can, a musician gets everybody dancing. That gets them out of the routine of the culture. So dancing can be anti-environmental. All the arts and sciences are critical.
Okay.
But they have different sensory versions, different media, depending on the society they're in.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. So what about, but if what you've said in the past that there can be, and tell me if I'm wrong, but there can be no artists today because everyone is now living inside of the situation under the satellite condition.
Right. What the question is, how does one throw light on the world we live in? How do you create a light through? How do you create a way of providing, as Zappa would call it, aristocratic poise, aristocratic detachment, a way of not being fooled by the environment and conditioned by it? Where do you begin? This was the problem Joyce started. And Lewis came up with it. He wrote a book, Wyndham Lewis, in 1934, Men Without Art. He was describing how hard the traditional role of the artist to offer this insight was in a mass media society. And then McLuhan picked up that problem. He said, what's the role of the book? He invented a way to write books that he thought were able to show light, hold up the environment, a mirror. Remember, it's the famous story of the Gorgon monster. Whoever was it, Perseus, one of those Greek guys, mythical characters, he took on Gorgon the monster, who, if you looked at him, he would turn you to stone. You didn't have a chance if you looked directly at Gorgon the monster. So he came up with a mirror, and he reflected Gorgon's image into the mirror, so he wasn't looking directly at Gorgon, and he slew the Gorgon monster because he found a way to deflect. So, and that's the role of the artist, the critic, is to provide a way of showing the situation without numbing you, without creating another hypnosis.
Okay.
So the mirror image that Perseus used is a archetypal example of the role of metaphor. You hold up, all arts and sciences and criticism are media mirrors, or what McLuhan called the analogical mirror. You reflect back what's happening, and it's the only way to deal with the environment. So everybody's always embedded in the present in their conditioning. So how do you get that mirror to show you what you're inside of, because what you're inside of is turning you to stone? So Gorgon was a dramatic metaphor for the power of the environment over you. Okay, so what is the mirror today? You got so many mirrors. You got movies, music, all the entertainment. They're all analogical mirrors. They're all criticisms. They're all enhancements of the situation. What is the role of the traditional individual mind? Or even McLuhan definitely didn't put on the individual mind. He said the critic had to be a corporate role, had to not have his personal views in there. It was the only way to deal with such a colossal, electrified, impersonal environment. So right. What is the way to make an analogical mirror? And none of the arts can do that. None of the arts can do it. That's why we come back to Finnegan's Wake. It is the most furthest out expression, the most ridiculous Baroque mirror, but it's a way of actually looking at the dynamism that goes on in the Gorgon monster of the environments we live in, and all the entertainments, and all the drugs, all the informational drugs. So what's the mirror today? And that's what Meltzer is wrestling with. He's trying to figure out, he's saying, look, I took philosophy, that doesn't really help me with rock and roll and rock. But rock is doing something. It's some kind of criticism of my environment, or at least inspire me to look at what's going on. And then he wrestles with that because that's just a literate response to it. And so he doesn't know if rock is a mirror or not, or whether there can be a mirror.
Okay. So bringing it down to the level of rock critics, then, is it more accurate to say that rock critics can't offer any real criticism, or that rock criticism in and of itself is not a form of criticism because it's only focused on the literary or chemical body response or something?
Or the consumption role. Yeah, you could say, is it rock criticism anti-environmental? Now, part of McLuhan said in an interview in the late 60s in Newsweek or something, he said, we do this because everybody else is doing it. And, like, here's everybody in the late 60s trying to be an independent, not be a subject to mass conformity. And McLuhan's putting on that, I have no problem being involved in the mass. That's the other aspect. Once, whether you even need an anti-environmental role anymore, McLuhan's questioning in the 60s. Because the environment itself provides anti-environment, because a new technology comes in, upsets everything that people assume, and it makes people wonder what the heck's going on and knocks them out of their habits of perception. And then you have a turnover of these technological inventions, what McLuhan called a rapid series of ersatz anti-environments. A rapid sequence of innovations is an ersatz anti-environment. It's a fake anti-environment, but it's the only anti-environment we're going to get. So he wasn't too concerned about using the individualist mind as an anti-environment. He knew that wouldn't work anymore. So actually saying things like, well, I mean, here's this guy looking like he's in an environment in the mid-60s, coming out with statements like, well, I have no problem with going on. We just try to get along. You know, he's not maintaining the Ben Watson, you know, anti-environmental critical stance,
okay,
so to speak. So he raised the question whether it can be an anti-environment, says the technologies and those new quick environments that come every couple of months, or no, let's say every few years back then, they were anti-environmental. So what do you do about that? Well, basically, he thought you can be an anti-environmental by pointing that out, because nobody noticed it.
Okay.
Nobody was saying that. So rock criticism is just it's almost like if the technologies are anti-environmental, that means that anybody can be an anti-environment for 15 minutes. And the Beatles were that, the Stones were that, Mickey Mantle was that, Babe Ruth, whatever is attracting attention that reinforces your cultural values, which are being shattered all the time. See, the new role of criticism becomes a preservation as well as a revolutionary radical movement. Because if the environment is changing you, maybe you might want to provide a way for people to feel secure in all those changes.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Now, music definitely does that. Music is the drug of the 20th century. It gives people instant comfort.
To stabilize.
Yeah, and that might be a useful anesthetic or anti-environmental role because it calms you down, gives you a little satisfaction. So rock criticism is a statement within the realm of rock music or entertainment consumption of music, and so it's a subset. It's definitely not not on the big level that you said we've just come down to. You said, okay, let's bring it down to the rock criticism level where I was talking on the vast level of the role of the shaman critic. So it's on a puny level, but what's funny is that the critics think they're at the top of the mountain. They think they got some important cultural role, the rock critics, and they don't want to see how puny it is what they're doing. They're just operating in the music industry, and that's Meltzer's dilemma. He quickly sees that. He says, what's the point of doing any of this stuff? And then he tries to figure out, though, how to continue being a writer. So he probably doesn't have work in the factory, right?
So it
takes him a while to figure out how to get a role to write and not have to be stuck in the industry. So he ends up in California and writing for weekly papers. But there's nothing to be taken. Rock criticism is not something to be taken seriously, but we can use it to show some interesting dimensions of what's going on, which is what I always do. I always take what's given and then show some interesting patterns. Like McLuhan says, if I'm in a bad movie, I get patterns out of that too. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you're getting processed by the entertainment information environment you're involved in. That's a given. You're getting processed. If you're getting all upset about it and not hating the music, well, that's okay. But if I could find a way to make some thinking out of it and then express it to someone or in a public forum, that's interesting. But I don't put any... We can't beat the Android meme. You can't beat the Android meme. And what is maybe inexcusable is people who claim that their writings or criticism or their role as a consumer guide is offering something revolutionary or practical or big. No, it's only temporary what they're doing, and we got no problem with that. Yeah, someone's got to just tell you what albums came out this week, and if you're interested, and you got to figure out what to consume. But that's all gone now. Jesus, nobody controlling any consumption. Everybody consume whatever they want for free.
Right. Okay.
So, but we're going back to the interesting sociological phenomenon of baby boomers, and they think the ultimate cultural goal is to be a writer, a Norman Mailer or a Tolstoy or something. They have that goal as a writer, and we watch them flounder around for 40 years trying to be a writer.
That's my life you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's a lot of people. A lot of people, educated people, are in that fate.
Yeah.
In that syndrome. It's not just you.
For sure.
And I look at it as, okay, here's a Westerner, you know, trying to be a Westerner, trying to keep writing and books on the IA visual space going as a critical and environmental role. And you will see that the only book that does it is Finnegan's Wake. If you want to look at a potential anti-environment, critical, shamanistic role, The Wake does it. And it preserves the writerly phenomenon. But, of course, you can't just stay with that, so then you have to come up with new ways to translate or redo what The Wake was doing, and that's what McLuhan did.
Okay. And are you providing an anti-environment?
Yeah, I'm the update of that tradition. I mean, my charts have Finnegan's Wake embedded in them. It's all about Finnegan's Wake. And then I have a patina of Zappa level there, because Zappa is an updating of The Wake in the post-book world.
Okay. We won't go into this in detail now, or I don't, maybe we won't ever go into detail of this, because you've done it elsewhere, no doubt. But just, I don't know, I'm thinking, you know, you keep mentioning Finnegan's Wake, and you know, this is kind of a thing about rock criticism, and I'm sure if anyone's listening to this, they're probably going, what, Finnegan's Wake, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So the question I have about Finnegan's Wake, and I do own a copy of the book, and I've, you know, tried to sort of read it, and I'm determined, you know, to kind of keep trying. But really, how do you read it? Like, I know Marshall McLuhan had the point about, well, you read it like TV or something, and you open a page, and, you know, you read it like dots on the page or something. But then I know you and Ben Watson said something interesting once, where I think Ben was saying, making the point that, you know, I don't read Finnegan's Wake to just wash over me. I actually, implying that he actually is, like, reading it and absorbing each. I don't know. I'm confused. Like, how do you tell someone who knows? Because I was trying to even explain these conversations to my brother, and I don't think he really even heard of Finnegan's Wake, and I'm kind of trying to describe it to him. And he was like, you know, he was like, wow, what is that? Like, it sounds real.
Yeah, it's a UFO.
I could not begin to tell him how to read it, because I haven't figured out how to read it.
Okay, so here's the story I tell, which is the best thing to say to people. Because why does McLuhan say that Finnegan's Wake is not a book, it's a radio program? Well, here's the story to explain that. Here's Joyce in the 20s. He's produced a great novel, 1922, Ulysses, and he's making a splash with it, and it seems pretty avant-garde, and it influences a lot of people, and he's a culture hero, at least in Europe. The book gets banned in America, and there's a lot of notoriety on that level, and that's still 1934. So here he is sitting there. Now he's thinking, okay, what am I going to write next? You know, he's a writer. What's he going to write? So he has a shortwave radio, and he's listening to shortwave radio, and he can hear German, Dublin, then Danish, English, French, all this stuff on his shortwave radio. And he's thinking, geez, I am writing about being an exile from Dublin, but I can go and hear Dublin on my shortwave radio. I'm right there. So where am I? And so he thought, well, let's since everybody was just, this was the new technology, radio, the new amazing, wonderful thing, Windows 95, okay, and this is an amazing experience for people. So he goes up and down the dial and hears all this stuff. Now he's saying, now this is what a lot of people are living inside of. This is the Gorgon. This is the monster that they're enjoying or getting pissed off at, and political movements are starting up with the radio. You know, guys getting on there and ranting like Hitler. And he says, how does the book provide an anti-environment or a mirror to this situation? Well, he thinks to himself, why don't I just paint what the thing is? So I'll paint on each page, or on my first page, going up and down the dial of the shortwave radio, or the radio, whatever it is. I think it's shortwave at that point. And so he just collaged a whole bunch of different languages. So you look at a book page, and you see these different languages, and you can't read 99% of it, but you see, you recognize all these different languages. He's saying, look, you can't read this. You think you have to read it, and you don't understand these languages, but you actually are having this experience if you have a shortwave radio. You're living this. You can turn the dial and hear German. You don't know what it is, but you can hear it. He is painting the actual present environment of communication. It's just a painting of the present.
Okay.
It's like saying, here's what you... I'm reflecting back to you what you're experiencing in our society. So then once he that's the hidden ground, or that's what you're actually seeing, and most people don't get that, they don't notice that he's just painting shortwave radio experience, which is around for anybody to have. So they start reading the book as a book and try to figure out what the languages mean. And so Joyce is like probably laughing. They can't see. And then he writes a book. Then he fills in the thought content. He fills in lots of ideas, saying, isn't it interesting? A new environment comes in, and people can't see it. They think it's the previous environment. And you can find all kinds of quotes, and McLuhan's really good at pointing out these quotes in his book, McLuhan's book, War and Peace in the Global Village, 1968.
Right.
All kinds of key Finnegan's Wake quotes, which, if you know what I'm saying, applies to Finnegan's Wake. You can see these quotes tell you, they're Joyce telling you what he's doing. And you can read them once you understand that. And like there's, what was I going to say? There was one where he says on page 81 of Finnegan's Wake, I think I've said this before, the viability of vicinals are invincible if invisible.
Okay.
So the vicinals are your immediate environment. So what radio's doing to us are invisible if you can't see the environment. And he knows you're not seeing it right in your book form. in his book, which was at that time called Work in Progress. So you can see him saying, oh, the print did that, writing did that, speech did that. They were all invisible environments that people walled around in and didn't know the effects of. Okay. So he was, and he says, now with such a rapid change in new inventions, we can actually see the look, radio, look what it's doing to us, look what it's made up of, and people don't recognize when I show it in a book form.
Okay.
So he says, that's right now in the 20th century, early part of the 20th century, we have enough rapid change that I can actually begin to see this pattern. So he actually came up with a new shamanistic vision.
Okay, so I wouldn't want to get hung up on this point, but I am kind of curious. Like, is it actually, is it documented that he, like with the shortwave radio thing, like he had that actually kind of triggered the book? Or?
Yeah, you can, people visit him, said he would listen to the radio. You know,
okay.
There's no statements. You see, the first section of Finnegan's Wake, the very first, it wasn't called Finney's Wake, but he wrote about, I think it was five or six little vignettes, which seemed to be about quaint fables. And,
right.
But in one of them, it's on page like 382, 383 of Finney's Wake, he describes King Roderick. He says, King Roderick, the last pre-electric king of Ireland. There it is, pre-electric.
Yeah.
And then he says, Radio Beamer Tower. You see the reference to radio right there in the first sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's on page 383. Later in the final book, you don't know it's the beginning part, the first thing he wrote, unless you do some scholarship, you know.
Right.
Read some books and find out what was written first. But he, the last pre-electric king of Ireland, because he's talking about like 1200 A.D., and then Ireland's in slavery for 800 years. Like Henry II comes over from Bristol or something and it begins to enslave Ireland in 1200 or something like that, which is very close to the date that's sprinkled all the way through the book, 1132.
Okay.
So there it is, talking about modern technology right away in the first sentence. The last pre-electric king. Now, it's 1922-23, and Dublin is finally, Ireland has finally had its revolution, becomes its sort of an independent country in 1922.
Right.
So he's saying, wow, radio allowed these guys to pull it off and recapture Ireland.
Okay.
Not all of it. They didn't get Northern Ireland, but it was the beginning. So he was processing the events going on in his own country and looking at the hidden ground of communication that made it possible.
Okay.
So you're saying, you know, your brother can tune into, used to be able to tune into CKLN, and someone is playing some collage, some sampling stuff.
Right.
You have to say, this is how Joyce saw the environment he was in with radio, and he painted it on the book. He's like, he cut and pasted like an assemblage. People thought he was writing prose and typing. Well, you know, he was collaging like the Dadaists who were doing it with paintings.
Right.
But no one thought someone could do that in a book.
So when you're reading it, is that...
That's the beginning. That's the beginning.
Is that what you're looking for, sort of thing?
Well, you look at the book and you say, okay, I'm not going to find a story in here.
Yeah.
You know, this is a collage. This is a sampling of his environment. But what's interesting is that he organizes it with 10 thunders, each one referring to a phase in technological history. And then you look at the cluster of words that he planted in around each thunder, and you see how it becomes dated to each era. Then you begin to see how to see the patterning and how the story, if there's a story, it's about some guy who's a tavern keeper and his wife is cleaning up the tavern and putting the kids to bed, and that's all it is. It's actually just showing, the story is a bunch of humans in a tavern listening to the radio.
Right.
And eventually a TV shows up there. And it's just their daily life. It's like a day in the life. Ulysses is a day in the life of Leopold Bloom during the day. Well, this is like Leopold Bloom dreaming at night. But Joyce recognizes that the dream has been extended into movies and radio. So they're dreaming awake. Finnegan's awake. So you start getting fragments, enjoying the ideas and patterns you get from skipping around the book, like you would if you were listening to the radio, skipping from dial to dial. That's the experience. So it's not a book. That's how you begin. and you don't spend time trying to figure out what each line means, at least not at the beginning. Later, since there's so many scholars who have done that, there's now Roland McHugh's annotations. He lists the top three interpretations of every line almost. And then you can start looking for book kind of content and ideas. But it all melts away under the larger dynamic of that it's not a book.
Okay.
So it's rock and roll in print.
Right, okay. But Ben countered, when you said that it was rock and roll in print, he seemed to have some problem with that, saying that, you know, rock and roll itself is not something you can put into print.
Right. Well, I don't know if he would say that, but, you know, he wasn't
maybe
sure.
I might be misinterpreting.
Yeah, he doesn't like, well, he thinks he's a writer. He's, what, logocentric, loves to talk or use his mouth and to write. He is using Finnegan's Wake for writerly images and ideas and to mold his mouth and speak and say and play with sound.
Right.
He's focusing on only one or two of his senses, whereas the Wake is there for all the senses and for the extended senses, which are the technologies. He's only gradually, now he's writing to me saying, I'm beginning to appreciate the electric ether or see what McLuhan's pointing at and how that could be hinted at in the Finnegan's Wake. So he sees Finnegan's Wake as a book, but not limited to normal book literary standards, and it's something to play with. And that's a valid use of the book, but I include other levels.
Okay. Well, let's move on to case study Frank Zappa.
Right.
So we're going to go into some of the Meltzer stuff, Meltzer and Zappa, Meltzer versus Zappa, Meltzer plus Zappa, however you want to look at it. But explain what you've meant on several occasions when you've described Frank Zappa as not really being a musician.
Like Finnegan's Wake, it's not a book. I mean, Zappa is quoted as saying that he's a communicator who will use anything to get across a point. His interviews, TV shows, he always wanted to have a TV show. He just wanted to get into the mix. So he wasn't trying to... Okay, we should say it this way. In 1967, you ever read the Jazz and Pop interview with him?
I don't think so.
Okay, it's probably available online somewhere. Here he is in Jazz and Pop being interviewed, and he says, I'm starting a political party called the Interested Party. And within a year, he's talking about, among his colleagues like Cal Schenkel, the artist, and maybe some of the others, about running for president. But he doesn't really, he talks about it, but he claims that Tom Wilson, is it? Yeah, the producer.
Yeah, he
in a couple interviews he has discussions of Tom Wilson running for president. The point is Zappa saw that the media could be hijacked, at least, you know, from his young perspective, not on the deep McLuhan level, which would say, no, you can't hijack it, you can only maybe do it for 10 minutes. That was Warhol's insight. But Zappa thought, let's use this medium, this pop radio that has access to all these smart kids or just kids, and we can get them organized as a political force. He purposely went into rock to organize a political force. Remember the For the Money album, the song, Where the Mother People, Where the Other People Found a Way to Get to You?
Right, yeah.
And to organize you. So he is taking the technologies of the day, the communication forms, and hijacking it. He's not just trying to be an entertainer or to be a composer. That is the front. That's the alibi. Oh, we're here to play you music, you know, for your high school dance or something. Or we're here to entertain with the symphony orchestra. But he has an agenda. He's going to use that medium, music, to be a temporary critic, wake you up, give you a relief, you know, be the shamanistic role. But he had a larger agenda because he said, man, we can use this to get power. Now, that's what any real artist is a serious artist is doing that. They are criticizing society, and they say, I think maybe I should be running it. You know what I mean? I think I'd do it better than you, sir.
Right.
You know, there is that megalomaniac level. And you know, it's very interesting, the jazz and pop interview where Frank Kosky's interviewing him. And Zappa, this guy's just saying, hey, you put on a good show here at the Garrick Theater. It's very entertaining. Well, Zappa says, well, yeah, well, I'm starting a political party. And like, he might have thought, well, that's odd, or megalomaniacal or something.
Wow. Wasn't Frank Kosky a very political writer?
Yeah, he was a Marxist critic.
He was a Marxist, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and in that interview, I think I've discussed it with Ben, he brings up Bertolt Brecht. He says, you're like Bertolt Brecht. And Zappa's never heard of Brecht. And Kosky can't believe it, because Kosky he's older than Zappa, I think, but he's come out of a critical tradition, the left critic, and Bertolt Brecht is a hero in that world, and he thinks Zappa is a left-winger. You know, they think he's projecting this countercultural left-wing thing into Zappa, and he can't believe that Zappa is making powerful art but has not been groomed in the right areas or the proper studies, has
right.
done his Brecht study. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
And that's because that's where Kosky doesn't understand McLuhan said in 1966-67, we're going to see, Twiggy's just the beginning, we're going to see all kinds of bizarre, strange forms showing up, or strange people, because there's lots of room for them to show up in. There's a whole new vast media environment that needs to be filled up. So Kosky, he doesn't know how someone like Zappa could come and appear to be revolutionary and have no reference point that Kosky had.
Okay, yeah.
Much like me and Ben. Kosky is Ben, and I'm Zappa. I'm running a revolution, and Ben's saying, well, where are you using Marx? Are you quoting Marx? Where's Marx here, you know?
Right. Kosky, I think, took a lot of flack. I read a really great book about a year ago on the history of jazz criticism, and he took a lot of flack for being, like, very Marxist-oriented with, like, I think he did some book on Coltrane or something, and he tried to do the same. Yeah, he tried to fit Coltrane's music into this, like, sort of leftist perspective or something, and, you know, most people saying that's ludicrous, it's ridiculous, whatever. But
yeah, he disappeared. I don't know what happened to Kosky. I mean, he didn't have much staying power.
Hmm. So did Zappa ever anywhere comment on, to your knowledge, McLuhan?
Well, with me, a couple times. Nothing.
Oh, you must have asked him, obviously. You interviewed him, right?
Oh, but I knew him since 1958, so I was always telling him about McLuhan. But here, he never said anything in public. There's nothing, no comment written or uttered. It's like he didn't know who McLuhan was. But when I first was talking to, when I first was mentioning McLuhan to Zappa, I showed him the black book, The Medium is Massage, came out in 67. He says, yes, someone gave that to him recently because it was big in 67. Everybody was looking at it. It just was around
right.
everywhere. He says, yes, someone showed me that, Bob, and I read it on the airport. And then, interesting, but he had no more say about it. All right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, through the years, I'd be mentioning McLuhan here and there, but he wouldn't respond. So finally, in March 85, middle of March, I went up to his place on Woodrow Wilson Drive, and he brings it up. He says, hey, Bob, I just saw the documentary on McLuhan, which was done by his daughter, McLuhan's daughter, Stephanie McLuhan, and it was on CBC or something first and did well, and then PBS played it. So he had never, other than there's a diary entry where I put him together with McLuhan and LaRouche, you know, if you go into my diaries, you'll see on June 18th, 1967, read that gathering. But nobody knew then who anybody was. This was before Zappa was famous, before McLuhan was famous, before LaRouche was famous, before Mae Brussel was famous, and the other people I have in there, okay?
Okay.
And you'll see by the entries, what people say, they don't know who each other is. And so probably out of that is when I showed him the Medium is Massage book, so Zappa realized who he was with. And so he read the book, and he had no comment on it. And you might see some of his comments on McLuhan in that diary, because they all comment on each other. And they comment on Krishnamurti, who comes and speaks to them. So anyways, this was set up in Stanley's Bar in the village where Walter Bowie used to work in the early 60s. Okay, so here we are in 1985. I've been trying to get him to talk about McLuhan or take an interest, but he's reluctant. And Zappa he would talk about events, but always from his point of view. He never really discussed other people's ideas. He would discuss his reaction to what was going on in the media or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right, right, okay.
So, what was I? Okay, so he says, I saw the interview with McLuhan, the documentary, and he says, he looked like he was not all there, Bob. And I said, well, that's because McLuhan was an actor. He was putting on. You're picking up something that's not genuine there, or something that's not involved like a normal person being interviewed. Well, you have to realize that McLuhan was saying things as a stick to hit you over the head with.
Right.
So, and he was doing very casually. So, yeah, maybe it would look like he's not all there, but it's a cagey way McLuhan was being. And okay. So, and that was the last time we talked about McLuhan. I mean, it was, that was the only. So, he probably didn't agree with me. He said, no, he wasn't all there. But that's what here's McLuhan, a Canadian academic, a stuffy guy probably to someone like Frank, and he just couldn't, he had no clue what McLuhan was talking about.
Yeah.
he was like, the guy is like not staying on topic. He's not all there. He can't focus. You know what I mean? It's something like that.
So would it be similar to Meltzer in some ways, though, that about like Zappa and Meltzer both, you know, obviously would be aware of McLuhan, and neither of them maybe had any clue as to what McLuhan was actually saying, but in their own ways, they're actually kind of mining similar terrain or something? Or?
Well, they're both trying to be critics, and McLuhan was a critic of the society, and they're trying to be critics. And they are dealing
with, you mean, right?
Beg your pardon?
When you say, you mean like anti-environment.
Right. And they both are, let me say, they're both being, all three are being anti-environmental. But Zappa and Meltzer are kids compared to the level McLuhan's talking on. I mean, there are professors, what was his name? James Carey, famous American professor who got interested in McLuhan and Harold Innes in the 60s. Well, Lance Straight and those guys at Fordham University who started the Media Ecology Association, they also were part of the New York State Communication Association. So I went to one of these things in the fall of 98, and James Carey gets up. He's the keynote speaker and tells his story about how he was met McLuhan, liked McLuhan, then decided McLuhan was not really worthy, and Harold Innes was better. But the interesting thing is, this is 1998, and he's wrestling with the fact McLuhan has come back stronger, being the patron saint of Wired, and is back in the news, and Carey's trying to figure out, well, why did this dumb McLuhan come back? You know, he's trying to figure it out. So he confesses, so he went into a confessional. He said, when McLuhan came to my university, I was very active in helping kids to avoid the draft. You know, he was a young professor, part of the, whatever you call that radical group that was trying to save kids from going to Vietnam. And McLuhan came in, and I wanted to, harness this great mind to help our cause. And he says McLuhan was totally indifferent to the Vietnam problem. He would just say, well, this is just Custer's last stand, or it's hot politics and the cool medium of TV, you know, there's vast, quote, generalizations, and he would not get involved with the issues for the students. And that really angered James Carey, so he said, well, McLuhan's not hip. He's not involved. He's off in his own world. He's not all there. He doesn't even understand what the problems we have today. And discounted him from that point on and got into celebrating Harold Innes. And then became a famous communications professor himself. Got awards, got a position at Columbia, and still had to wrestle with the ghost of McLuhan. So I talked to him later about some of this stuff, but the thing is that they didn't understand. Here's McLuhan comes to a country. he's talking to the whole country and then going to China and speaking to them, then going to Australia and speaking to them. Why should he get involved in each little country's problems? He's trying to offer a huge level. He's saying, look, we got all these problems in different countries. Vietnam is one of them in the States. The reason is we got television. We need to turn off television for 6 months, and that'll improve a lot of situations, is what McComb right. believed. And he would apply that to all cultures all over the place. And, well, you don't have much TV, so we'll give you TV. Over in America, you got too much. We need to turn it off for 6 months. But we're going to, in Australia, we're going to have more TV for a while because you got too much radio, and that makes you different. Look at the vast scale he's operating on. So he was acting out Gulliver's Travels, you know. Lemuel and Lilliput, all these little midgets were saying, well, come and help us with our birthday cakes, you know. We're out of chocolate, and, you know. Or our kids are being killed by a monster, and he's just passing through and offering a huge, big level of anti-environmental perspective. Okay, look at that level. Meanwhile, Frank is trying to figure out how to get in the White House. Meltzer's just trying to make a living,
right.
And they're being anti-environmental on another level.
Okay.
So definitely Meltzer's trying to be anti-environmental in a smaller context,
yeah.
And so is Zappa. Zappa's on a bigger level than Meltzer, but not on the level of McLuhan.
Okay.
But then the big levels, McLuhan understood this, there was no bird's eye view anymore. The big level I'm implying McLuhan was on was super aware, because you couldn't have that visual perspective flying over the landscape and looking at the lay of the land from high up as an eagle. You couldn't do that. That was eye-based. You couldn't have a lofty position on the top of the mountain anymore. And so McLuhan even knew that what he was saying can be just considered a local stuff like Meltzer or Zappa, because there is no mountain to look at things
right.
from anymore.
But he was pointing it out in these.
Yeah, that he was on a new kind of mountain. He was in the middle of society, sitting beside Meltzer and Zappa, talking about the new mountain, which is not eye-based. It is looking at the ground of the tactile effect. It's like a right. different level of ESP.
Okay.
So, so that's now you see, you get Meltzer complaining about Zappa, the master, the lofty guy, in the little world of rock, right?
Right, right, yeah.
He's saying, like, it's almost like Meltzer is a little Lilliputian and Zappa's a Lemuel, and he kind of resents that. And the reason he resents it, because everybody subconsciously knows that everybody's canceled out, so everybody's in the same boat, so you can't be superior to me.
Right.
But only McLuhan could explain why that was the case and how to change it from that.
Okay.
So that's a level of superiority McLuhan was justified in having.
Okay.
But he was not being the traditional kind of a superiority literary complex.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, it's interesting what you're describing about Meltzer and Zappa, and you said in our second chat or something, you used the word skittish to describe Meltzer in trying to write about Zappa. I think I'm in full agreement with that, but you kind of have to do some reading between the lines when Meltzer is writing about Zappa in some ways, because my sort of contention is when I look at the excerpts of stuff he's written on Zappa and Aesthetics of Rock, it's almost like he's not fully prepared to, like, deal with him or something, and I sort of sense in some places that he's kind of almost suggesting that this guy is kind of doing what I'm talking about, and I don't know if I'd say go as far as he's saying how dare he, but almost like, but you know, I like he's not really getting it. Or
yeah,
he writes about him very differently than anyone else in the book. Like, I mean, even Dylan, he sort of, you know, Dylan is just kind of another guy that he can use his music for his own sort of means. But with Zappa, there seems to be a slight bit of confusion or something there.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it exactly.
I can pin it down.